Welcome to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlo Demirgerdichyan from the Armenian Studies Program. Welcome back for joining us for another edition of All Things Armenian. It's been a really beautiful week here in Fresno, a lot of good weather coming up. We had last week talked about April 24th and the Armenian Genocide. This week, my guest is Dr. Richard Hovhannisyan, who is the Professor Emeritus of Armenian History at UCLA and the holder of the Armenian Educational Foundation Chair in Armenian History. And he's also a Presidential Fellow at Chapman University. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Thank you very much.
Good to have you.
Well, it's good to be back in Fresno for a while.
Yes. Thank you for joining me. Can you tell us a little bit about... I wanted to talk a little bit about your background and how you got involved in teaching, beginning, I think, earlier at UCLA, but you've been in the field of Armenian studies now for more than a half century, close to 60 years. Could you tell us a little bit about how that all began, how you got interested in Armenian history in particular, and then how you began at UCLA?
Well, I think, I grew up in Tulare and graduated from Tulare High School and always had an interest in history and interest in teaching. That's what I wanted to become. I remember taking a questionnaire of what you want to be, and I said teacher, and I'm happy that I spent my career teaching, but I wasn't particularly interested in Armenian history, but history in general. I was aware that we were Armenian immigrants, and my father was a survivor of unspeakable atrocities, but we didn't go much beyond that. And so as I developed into my teens, I suppose, I had a greater interest. And then I started reading Armenian history. I couldn't read any Armenian at the time. But my father subscribed to the Armenian Review, which is an English language journal that dealt with history and literature and so forth. And that sort of got me interested in Armenian things. And as I went on, I came after high school, my first 2 years here to the old campus of Fresno State, which is now the community college. And there was sort of exposed more to Armenian things, including my future wife, Vartiter, who sort of encouraged me to learn Armenian. And so it was. You know, I went on to Berkeley, and there I became something of an activist, an educational director of the Armenian Youth Federation and various other positions until I tried and decided that I wanted to write about things Armenian. So when I was in Berkeley, it's interesting, you know, I wanted to write about Armenian history, but there was nowhere to write. That is, there were no professors, as there are today, who could teach Armenian history or anything near Armenia. The closest thing I could get to Armenia was a course on the Balkan Peninsula, where the professor, his name was Yelovich, fortunately gave two lectures out of a semester on the Eastern Question, and that included Armenia. But I did have some wonderful professors who did allow me to sort of write on Armenian subjects, even though that was not their field. And from there, of course, I felt the need that if I wanted to be serious about Armenian history and Armenian studies, that I really had to know the Armenian language and to be able to read it. And so at the invitation of Simon Voratsian, who was the last prime minister of the First Armenian Republic, I spent a year in Beirut where I learned to read and write and sort of shed a part of my Harpertsi Dahom, the kitchen Kitchen Armenian and pick up the semi-literary East Western Armenian.
And because you started, I mean, you said you started in the, you were going to college in the 50s and early 60s, and there were very few sources on Armenian studies per se. Can you tell us what did you read that, what could you read? What were there?
There really wasn't much. Maybe there were 20 or 30 books, but there was one by Jacques de Morgan, who was a French writer, but had been the history of the Armenians had been translated to English. And then there was Kurkcan through the, I think, an AGBU publication, who also wrote the history of Armenia. And so those are the main things. But only the problem was with nearly all the sources that wrote about Armenia, they ended with the last Armenian kingdom of Cilicia in 1375. And then everything after that was sort of compacted into a few pages. So very little to go on, but enough to, you know, as I said, the Armenian Review began in the 1950s. So I had that available to me. And then Armenian newspapers, there was the Armenian Mirror, Armenian Spectator, Armenian Week, Haydinik Weekly, where you could get information and news about Armenian things, including little tidbits of Armenian history.
Once you learned Armenian, did that open up more sources? In other words,
absolutely. Yeah. There was so much written about Armenia and the Armenian language. It's like we say that a lot of times that, the Armenians didn't write about the Armenian genocide because they didn't want to remember it. But if you look at the Armenians, if you have the Armenian language, you see there are a great many sources on the genocide and memoirs. And it's the problem was that it was not made available to non-Armenian reading public. It was kept not intentionally, but the resources and the abilities kept it locked up in the Armenian world. And as you well know, increasingly, Armenian readers has steadily declined, particularly in the United States. The immigrant group read it, but unfortunately, we, their children, with exceptions, didn't learn enough of the language to be able to read those materials.
Well, now the period of time you were studying, 50s, 60s, this is when Armenia was part of the Soviet Union, but they were teaching history in Armenia. Were any of those sources available to you? Were you able to read any sources from Armenia, Soviet Armenia at the time?
I could certainly after I returned from Beirut, probably three quarters of my library were publications from Armenia, and because I was interested in modern Armenian history, many of them were either polemical or repetitive. You know, they had to praise the liberation that the Soviet rule brought to them and how terrible things were before, but still useful. And among the others, there were some very, very critical, when I say critical, fundamental works of scholars who bridged the pre-Soviet and the Soviet period, such as Hagop Manandyan, his Kanagan Batmachun of the Armenians. So those works were very fundamental in reading detailed. And then there were series of like 10 volumes or 12 volumes, probably intended for college level, but on different periods of Armenian history from ancient times to the modern period. So I relied very heavily on those, but I was always aware also of the political ramifications of what and what they couldn't write. It was sort of funny because even when they wrote things on ancient Armenian history, their preface always had to go back and talk about Marx and Engels and Lenin. But then when you got into the main part of the body, there, Marx, Lenin, and Engels were not anywhere present.
Mm. Now, it seems like you were embarked on a kind of detective work. In other words, you had to find these sources. And you just said how modern history was anything maybe from the 15th, 16th century all the way until the 20th century.
Yeah, right.
So how did you narrow down for your own work to start with your own doctoral work? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I was something of an idealist and a dreamer of an independent Armenian state, etc. I knew that there had been a short-lived Armenian republic after World War I. I didn't know much about it, but it was sort of the concept of having an Armenian flag and the United Nations Plaza and things of that type sort of made me very patriotic. And so I wanted to look at that period, critical period, which was also very, very controversial here. And I didn't understand why it was controversial, but I did know that one part of our community sort of idolized the red, blue, and orange flag of that first republic, and another part of the community, you know, looked upon it as being a symbol of misery that was supplanted by the Soviet flag, which represented to them security and protection from further invasions and genocide. And also, as we all understand, Soviet rule was it was sort of a policy in the Soviet Union to promote culture. So not only in Soviet Armenia, but throughout the Soviet Union, music and arts and drama were all encouraged so long as they could be kept within limits and not become what the Soviet authorities regard as becoming ultra-nationalistic. It was all right to be a patriot, whatever that means, but not all right to be a nationalist. So, Armenian musicians, authors, etc., were aware of this, and so there was significant cultural progress and universal education came to the Armenians as well as other people. So that segment of the population could certainly hang on to that as showing great progress and especially security for the Armenian nation.
Well, when you were doing that research on the First Republic, of course, the period when there's no internet, there's no easy access. Where did you have to really go? What were the main places went for sources?
We had to go to archives around the world. And Vartiter, my wife, although she was a physician, had a deep interest in history and also had linguistic help of advantages that were very helpful to me because she's fluent in Russian. She knew adequate German. She knew English. I knew the French, and I knew the English, and the Armenian. We both knew Armenian. So we had to travel to London, to Paris, to Beirut, to Washington, D.C., to go into the archives and then to the delegation of the Armenian Republic archives, where the Armenians after World War I had two peace delegations in Paris, one led by of whom were at work in Paris, and whose archives of Aronian, at least, well, both archives, ended up in the United States as a result of World War II. They were sent to the United States for safekeeping, or at least in the case of the Bois Nubar papers, photocopies or microfilms of those were sent here, but the original of Ovid Issaharonian's papers from Paris were sent to the Boston Heidenick building and were housed there down in the basement in very, very dusty, musty area. And we could tell when we opened up the packages to study the valuable information inside that there was dust, you know, like a quarter of an inch thick, which meant that they had sat there probably for 20 years without anyone having opened them. So it was really exciting. You know, I think that today researchers who have so much at their fingertips, and which is wonderful, are nonetheless deprived that excitement of going into these dark, musty archives, opening up files and packages and getting the original documents out and looking at the signatures of world leaders and leaders who are no longer remembered and now going through them. And it is being like an investigative historian. And really is investigation because in many of those packages, for example, the ones of Aronian, somehow whoever had organized those packages didn't realize that the first page of a document was 15 packets away from the second page of that document. And you had to be alert to saying, hey, this is a continuation. What do I saw back in 15 packets back? And it was fun. It was fun, exciting, and also you get to travel to different countries and live for a while with the local population and get a greater appreciation of the world.
Well, this is fascinating for sure. We're going to take a brief break and listen to some music by the Richard Hagopian Band. And then when we come back, I'm going to continue my conversation with Dr. Richard Hovhannissian about his career and about his life as a historian after our quick break. So let's take a break and we'll be back in a moment.